Today's Teisho will be on case 9 in the Hikigan Roku, the Pienu, the Blue Rock Collection. Case 9 is entitled Joshu's Four Gates. Engo's introduction. In the bright mirror on its stand, beauty and ugliness are both revealed. With the Bakuyu sword in hand, killing and sparing are brought under control. A handsome fellow disappearing, an ugly one comes. An ugly fellow disappearing, a handsome one comes. Life is found in death, death in life. If you have no eye to penetrate the barrier, no freedom to turn about, you will be lost on the way. Come, what is the eye that penetrates the barrier? What is the freedom to turn about? See the following. Main subject. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? Joshu said, the east gate, the west gate, the north gate, the south gate. Setcho's verse. Its intention concealed, the question came. The Diamond King's eye was as clear as a jewel. There stood the gates, north, south, east, and west, but the heaviest hammer blow could not open them. To thank everybody for doing such a wonderful job. It's now, for those of you who started on Tuesday night, it's now day 3 of your session. And if you're a beginner, if this is your first time at session, I should say, I want to congratulate you on still being here. That's a major achievement. Really. And it's wonderful. I mean, typically, people first timers who decide to leave would have already left, you know. So I'm not ruling out the possibility that you might still leave, but, and as I say, if you do that, you know, you can always, you know, don't take it, you know, as a defeat or something. But the fact that you've stayed really is a testimony to your courage and your, open-heartedness. And I'm very impressed, I must say. So hang in there. If you're still struggling, generally speaking, sometime around the third day, people begin to feel better, give or take a couple of days. But really, generally speaking, around day 3, mm-hmm. It's like there's a little switch in your body that goes on. And if you do more sessions, you'll notice that this is a pretty predictable trajectory. So, you know, usually day 1, people are, they're still, they have some energy, they have a lot of thoughts. Day 2, you begin to get really tired, and by day 3, you're, you know, by the end of day 2, that night of day 2, those last sits of the night are really hard to get through. I mean, at least that's how I remember him being. In fact, I can remember sitting on the cushion and like I was sitting up, but I was like dreaming on the cushion, you know. So I can just remember being on the cushion like exhausted on day 2 of my early session. But there's something around day 3 that will, you'll suddenly feel a sense, usually you feel a sense of release or something feels changed. And this is can be a very subtle change, but it can make a world of difference. It's like somehow you've stepped outside of your to some degree, you've stepped outside of your normal self. You know, the normal. It's like you occupy this place, and normally, which we call the self. And somehow you get outside of that a little bit, and it feels very refreshing and liberating. It's a wonderful feeling. In Zen, this is referred to poetically as a dying on the cushion, or dropping the body. Sometimes it can indeed feel like you've dropped your body. You know, you suddenly feel like the pain is not the pain is still there, but it's not necessarily your pain. And you're aware of it, but there's a space between you and your pain. And this is a really liberating moment, and that space can get quite deep, I guess is one way to put it, or quite profound. You can have this experience if you just keep using your breath. Don't forget to breathe with your hara. But if you keep watching the breath, if you focus your mind on the breath like a laser, you know, and you just keep sweeping everything away with the breath, you know, even though you might not believe me right now, there's a place inside you which is like absolutely imperturbable, and it's like the eye of a tornado or the eye of a hurricane. You know, when I was a little boy, we had a 4th of July party on the Navy base, and a hurricane came up. This was in Virginia, where they get a lot of hurricanes. And it was a huge affair. I mean, the sky turned black, and the winds were just howling. And we were all at the base pool, and for protection, we went into the men's shower room, and we all sort of sat there, and we could just hear this storm. It was, you know, limbs were falling off of trees, And then we opened the door and we came out, and it was like a sunny day. The sun was shining, and all these branches were lying in the water. And it was just, and all the tables with their umbrellas were overturned, had been overturned by the high winds. These were metal tables. And then all of a sudden the storm came back, you know, and we had to go back in. We were in the eye of the storm. And apparently, as it crosses over an area, you know, you get the wall of the storm, then you get the eye, and then there's another wall. Well, we were in the eye. Well, there's an eye, there's like an empty place, inside you, if you want to put it that way. There's an empty place, and normally we don't occupy that space. You know, we actually don't know how to occupy it, and in fact many people are afraid of it. You know, actually if they stumble into it, they're frightened of it. But when you're in sesshin, you know, you're like in an extraordinary situation, and you are not comfortable, you know, right? You're sitting on the cushion and your legs are hurting, and your impulse is to get up and move, get off the cushion and move, or to get in your car and drive away. And if you don't do that, you're sitting there with your discomfort, whatever it might be, and at that point you can, it's like you can undergo a shift in perspective, where you stop identifying with this thing we call the self, this place we call the self, And you can shift out of that and you enter this like empty place. And it doesn't really have a location in space, actually. And it doesn't really have any like characteristics. It's when you get there, it can be quite liberating because you can suddenly experience your pain with a little bit of distance. It's not like the pain totally disappears, but you're aware of it, but it's no longer like right at the center of your consciousness, you know. And this is what we call in Zen dropping the body or dying on the cushion. It's a transition point that you will experience many, many times. It can be physically quite interesting. I mean, everybody experiences it a different way, but when I'm in that state, I often feel like I'm just aware a little bit of my body, you know, like just my hands and part of my head, and I'm aware of having some pain in my legs, but it's like that most of me is a hollow, big hollow place, and my pain is off to the side, and anyway, this can become very deep, and there really is like a place place you can go to, which is like the eye of the storm, and no matter how crazy it is outside that place. No matter how much pain you have in your legs or no matter how much chaos and disorder there is in your environment, you can be absolutely still and imperturbable. And the point of doing breath perception is to be able to find that place. If you follow the breath out, you follow the breath out, you squeeze with the hara, at the end of your breath, you'll notice that there's like a cessation. There's some kind of a cessation for a moment of you could say awareness, or all self-centered awareness. And each time, you'll notice it. It's like there's pain in your legs and you start breathing out, and you breathe out, and as you get to the end of your breath, you'll notice there's like a little tiny interval there. At first it's very small, where there's just nothing. And you want to just keep going back there, and it's like that little interval gets to be a little wider after a while. Eventually it's like you shift from the place you start to you shift into that like empty place a little bit, and when that happens, it's like you've gone through this change of perspective. You've traded places, and in that empty place, it's much easier to deal with the pain. I remember once many, many years ago, more than 20, maybe 25 years ago, we had a sesshin at a place called Moses Lakes, Washington. And at that time, we didn't have our Zen temple up in the mountains, so we had to rent places to have sesshin. We were in some very nice places and some really terrible places. We never had a sesshin where they were doing road work, but we did have some truly terrible places. But one of the places we picked was on the eastern side of the Cascade Mountains, which is really desert, like New Mexico. It was very hot. I mean, we have sesshin here in August, and it can be pretty hot, but that was like, you know, like 100 degrees every day. And so it was very, very hot. And it was very beautiful though. It was out in the desert, and when we would be sitting in the Zendo at night, you could hear the coyotes howling. We would go off to bed, it was still like 85 degrees, you know, at 10:30 at night, still very hot. Well, anyway, during the day, I had a lot of pain, and it was made worse by the heat. You know, it was like the inescapable heat. You know, it's like every once in a while you could try to think cool thoughts, right? But that's just BS, you know. I mean, you know, you start sweating the minute you sit down on the cushion, right? And you realize, every once in a while you realize, oh man, it's really hot. And it's like inescapable. It's like yesterday I talked about the cold, you know. And cold is actually, I find, harder to take than heat, you know. I mean, for me, when it's, you know, 20-some degrees, it's like, if you're in like a robe or something, it's unbearable, you know. But the heat is also very difficult, and it keeps coming back no matter what you do. You try to go into Mushin, and you, sooner or later you have to come out of Mushin, and there it is, you know. And so the pain in my legs was quite acute also. And, you know, I had one of those moments where I just thought, I didn't often think of leaving Sesshin. I didn't have a car. But also, I was very existentially committed to doing this. You know, I loved Zen, even though I had incredible pain in my legs. But I believed that it would help me, and also, you know, something about it that was gripping for me. But I did have moments where I just thought, you know, I'm going to lose my mind if this goes on, you know. I'm just going to start screaming or something, you know. And anyway, toward the end of one day, I actually found this place after a number of years. I was a slow learner. But after a number of years of going to Sesshin, I found this place that was just like, it was just astounding to me, you know, that you could get into this place where your pain, I mean, literally, I was in there so deeply, it was like I had no pain. And I assure you that that is quite possible. And it's happened to people here in our Sangha. It's happened to people. And it happened to me, and it was just like a miracle. It was like, oh my God, this is fantastic. I mean, I just sat, and I sat, and I sat, and I went into Dokusan, and I said, Genki Roshi, you know, I've been in such agony, and now all my pain is gone. I know I'll never have pain again, you know. And, of course, the next day I had pain, you know. It's like yesterday I talked about the cold, and I said I had this terrible experience sitting in the cold on one particular occasion especially. And then, you know, you get outside of your small self and you suddenly feel better. But it wasn't like the next day I said, oh, cold doesn't bother me anymore. You know, every day I got up and thought, oh, I hate this cold, you know. But you can work your way towards this place, which is, you know, basically empty. And from that place, you can deal with your pain and other things too, right? I mean, other things. I was at 8:45. I go out to see outside to meet Mike. Actually, I should say Michael. Michael Masters is in charge of this facility. He's the manager of Murray Grove. And I went out to greet him, and I said, how are you? And he said, oh man, he said, the sound of those trucks, it's driving me crazy. You know? And he said, I'm so sorry. And, I thought maybe I should invite him in to do some zazen. He's been to Japan, but I didn't think he'd take me up on it, you know. But with something like this too, you know, as I've mentioned before, my you know, they designed that sound to be annoying, right? You know, it was actually like somebody tested it out. You know? I was wondering this morning, you know, it would be great if they made it like bird sounds, right? You know, why don't they make them like bird sounds? So it would be a beautiful trilling. You know, why not like trilling? Or, you know, each of these vehicles would have like a different bird sound. And we'd all sit here and think, oh, how beautiful, you know. But I guess maybe those guys wouldn't want to have a beautiful bird sound on their machine. My father-in-law worked for many, many years at the Los Alamos lab, and then he worked at the Sandia labs in Albuquerque. And I guess he was involved in some aspects of making the atom bomb, the atomic bombs. And I had no idea of that until he came to live at our house recently, and he was telling me about drawing the designs for the atomic bomb. He's been a wealth of information, actually, about many different things that I had no idea he was involved in. And he told me that that this beeping machine on the back of all these trucks and everything was invented at Sandia Labs. And he said he knew the guy who invented it. You know? And I thought, I'd like to talk to that guy. but it's really, I mean, nobody wants to. Michael Masters was very unhappy this morning because of his having to listen to this beeping. And when you sign up for Sashin, you don't necessarily sign up to be next to a construction site. But nevertheless, as I was saying yesterday, it's really good training, and it's vastly better than thinking. And working with something like pain, or something like that noise, or something like the cold, or something like the heat, is really excellent practice. Because not much can be done if you're totally comfortable. If you're sitting on the cushion and you're totally comfortable and you don't have a lot of pain and you're in samadhi, you know, you're in nice samadhi and you have a buzz on, you know. I mean, samadhi has a buzz-like element. It's very beautiful, you know. And I actually love samadhi, you know. It's so sweet and beautiful. And you can get into samadhi and you know, there are many people who practice meditation just to the point where they can get into samadhi. And that's quite common. And they think of it as like bliss or like the presence of the divine. And it's very sweet and nice, but it's not, from the Buddhist standpoint, that is not enlightenment, you know. But it can really be quite a prison, actually, to be stuck in samadhi. And one of the good things about koans is that it doesn't let you stay there, that you have to start struggling with these barriers. And there's a real life, you know, sort of like immediate koans too, and one of them is like being in an unheated temple. And, you know, it's just like inescapably nagging at you every moment. And that's such a productive situation. I mean, people came into the Dogasan room last night with everybody's really sitting deeply. Part of it is maybe just that, you know, that devilish little beeper, you know. You can't really, this phrase, I can't even hear myself think, you know. Well, you know, if it gets cold enough in a zendo, you can't even hear yourself think. You know, if it gets hot enough, you can't even, it's like you don't even have the strength to think, you know. And that little sound is trivial, but after a while it's like you can't hold a thought in your head. And believe it or not, that's really quite a precious attainment, because that's where real work can be done. Without, you know, you have to step out of yourself and you have to go to this empty place. And when you're in that empty place, you'll notice that your mind doesn't have a lot of thoughts, or doesn't really have any thoughts. It's a kind of thoughtless awareness. And in that thoughtless awareness, a lot can be accomplished. And so, even though you didn't sign up for this, it's actually like a lucky accident, because it compels everybody to either go mad, or you'll start emptying out your mind, and you'll notice, beep, 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 and between the beeps, you're actually quite blank, And even with the sits this morning, in the last period of meditation, we had the beepers going on, and in the two previous periods of meditation, a couple people were dozing, and one person was snoring, that happens to everybody. But a couple people were dozing, how do I know? Because I look around the Zendo and they're falling forward, right? By the way, in Japan, the people don't sit on the ground, they sit on a raised bench called a tan. And everyone, once in a while, I'm told, people go to sleep on the cushion and they fall off the bench onto the ground, and so a lot of these people have like scabs on their foreheads. And so you'll hear a thud, right? Anyway, I can look around the Zendo and I see people sort of lurching forward and catching themselves as they wake up before they hit the ground with a thud. The beeper came on and I looked around and boy, everybody was totally erect. Everybody was straight, their spines were straight, and so I don't think it's an innovation that's going to catch on in the Zendo, but I still think that having pressure, a little pressure like that, is very, very productive, those of you who are beginners, I want to thank, I wanted to recommend that you look for this place, this blank space at the end of your breath, and you keep pushing yourself back into that. It will be tremendously helpful to you. The whole point of Zen practice is to work through all of our barriers and become transparent or open. Now you could call that selfless if you want, or you could just say very open, right? When we are at a sesshin, we sit for 9 hours a day and we enter deep samadhi. And we go into that blank state. And then we observe some aspect of the moment. And that can include our own emotional life, our own emotional responses to events. It can include the actual empirical unfolding of events around us. So some koans really bring out obstacles that are emotional or personal in character, So you might be working with a koan and suddenly you realize that you're angry a lot, And this is a part of your self construction. You know, this is part of you might not, most people who have anger issues don't immediately know they have them, you know. Most people try to represent themselves, they try to narrate themselves or tell a story about themselves as basically the hero of the story. So if you have an angry, if you're an angry person, often you will say, you might not put it that way. You might say, well, I know I have a hot temper, but, you know, I'm a fighter. Or people who have problems with, like, envying others, they don't usually say, I know envy is one of my problems. I mean, mostly we conceal that stuff from ourselves. And we try to tell a story about ourselves that makes us out to be the hero of the story. And so even our defects can be turned into, like, positive features in our imagination. And as a result of this, we can be emotionally crippled and live a smaller life than we might otherwise. And not only that, but that even prevents us from being aware fully of the moment. Even emotional things that might seem to have very little to do with, like, quote-unquote enlightenment can become huge obstacles in your life, in our lives. So, when I started doing Zen training, I really wanted to be an A student in Zen. And I had this very powerful insecurity about myself and desire to be ratified by authorities. I was the kind of student who always had his hand up in class, and I wanted, when the teacher would go, "Yes, Kurt," I would feel real to myself. So this actually got in the way of my Zen practice a lot. At some point I was working with the koan, and I really began to see this aspect of myself. You know. So people have different kinds of coping strategies for dealing with insecurity or uncertainty. Some people, when they're the rug is pulled out from under them, when they're drifting in that, some people enter that empty space and experience it as a relief from suffering, like the pain in their legs. But sometimes it produces, like, anger, believe it or not, or other kinds of emotions, because that's how they respond to being in an unfamiliar place. You know, when some people are in a place that isn't controllable or familiar or knowable, they begin to get angry. And so, actually, many people who practice Zen have quote-unquote anger issues. And it's because that's how they've coped with uncertainty in their lives. This is karma. And some people have, like, self-loathing issues. Yeah? When they have been in a position of uncertainty, they wind up blaming themselves for not performing well. You know, and that might have to do with many factors in their lives. Some people become hyper-analytical. You know, some people just become, like, super duper analytical and self-referential. You know, this is a response to uncertainty. And some people lose themselves in fantasy. You know, that can include, like, sexual fantasies. You know? I remember there was this guy who was a member of our Zen group in Seattle, and he would always be fixating on some beautiful woman in the Sangha. And after the session, he'd go, "Oh, did you see Renee? I couldn't take my eyes off her, you know." And he said, all session, I was just sitting there thinking, oh, she's so beautiful. And I think what's going on there is that it's just, you know, this is how he responds to pain. You know, he consoles himself in this way. And also to uncertainty. We develop these coping strategies, right? But they're not necessarily productive, or they're not necessarily positive coping strategies. So some koans help us to encounter our inner obstacles, right? You know, and after a while you'll begin to see your own habits, your own mental habits. If you work with enough koans, you'll begin to see, there I go again, right? And here I am hating myself again because I don't know the answer to my koan. Or you'll say, there I go again, I'm fantasizing about this or that. Or, you know, I'm in hyper-analytical mode, and that's because I don't know what I'm doing right now. You know? And a lot of Zen practice, it requires you to get some distance. You go back to that empty place, and you look at your own defects. And wonderful things can happen, you know. It's very difficult for us to see our defects in ordinary life, and even when we're aware of them, it's very difficult for us to overcome them or to work through them. But just as being in that empty place can help you to deal with pain, being in that empty place can help you to work through your obstacles, you know. Now, some koans are not about your personal karma. They're more about perceiving the moment as it actually is. So some koans are asking you to report on something about reality as it's unfolding that isn't emotional in character or psychological. It's like empirical. And if you're in a very calm and still mind for a long time, you can begin to notice things about reality that ordinary people don't notice. And sometimes our psychological obstacles get in the way because we're so afraid, for example, of not knowing the answer to the teacher's question that we can't even relax and observe the moment, you know. But sometimes the problem is that we have too many assumptions about reality, you know. Sometimes people will be noticing something about the moment, and it's not what they think they should be finding, and they think they're failing at answering the koan, and that can trigger all kinds of psychological problems. But sometimes they're just not looking in the right place, and so again, you go back to that empty place, and you just stay in that empty place, and you know, sooner or later, you're going to notice something about the moment that the ordinary person with a fragmented consciousness can't possibly notice. There's something about the moment that koan gives you like a subliminal cue. It says, well, here's one. There's a koan that says, two monks both raise the blinds at the same time. They're identical monks. They raise the blinds at the same time. The blinds go up at the same time. And a Zen teacher who observes them points to one and says, you've got it, and points to the other and says, you don't. And in other words, he says, one hit, one miss. Now, I'm not giving anything away by telling you it's not about monks. You know? The koan is giving you a subliminal cue, and it's saying, look, there's something in the moment which is always present, which is like one hit and one miss. And you know, if you try to figure it out, you'll never figure it out, because you have to just let the subliminal cue sink down into your unconscious. And then you just, the mind just has to keep returning to the moment. You have to stand in the empty place and observe the moment. And sooner or later you're going to notice something about that moment, you know. And it might just be like this, and it's gone. But it could be just a momentary awareness of something, but that's sometimes how it happens, you know, just very fast. But for a second, you notice something about reality that ordinary consciousness is too fragmented to overlook, too fragmented to notice. So anyway, solution to your problems, no matter what they are, is to go into that empty place. Yes? And if you're struggling with your koan, you know, please just remember what I've said. These are like some pointers. Let your unconscious mind do the work. And be as blank and empty as you can, and try to have no presuppositions. You know, the proper mentality for doing Zen is sort of like experimentalist or observational. You know, once you're stepping outside of your small self, you're just going to observe what's happening. If you suddenly see anger in yourself, that's just anger, you know. And if you suddenly notice something about the moment that seems impossible, please just note it and report it in Dokusan. So anyway, it takes a lot of work to be open like Joshu. This monk said to Joshu, what is Joshu? And Joshu was a town in China. Zhaozhou was a town in China that had four gates. And Joshu said, I have been on the cushion many times in a lot of pain and frustration, and I've had to listen to many beeping vehicles, and I've been in the freezing cold, and I've been in the burning heat, and I've sat there thinking, I hate this, you know. But at some point I shift into that empty space, and I've spent my life there. One breakthrough it doesn't transform everything, but you know, you keep getting into these situations where you have to get out of your small self and into that empty place, and you do that again and again and again and again, and it is like water wearing away the rock. Yes, each time you do that, you're transforming yourself a little bit. The rock is very solid, and water is very soft, and it hits the rock, and you think nothing's ever going to change. But one day, you know, it's the Grand Canyon, you know. So you just have to be patient and keep doing your excellent practice. Everybody's just doing an excellent job, and I'm really thrilled with every person here. And just keep, the key is that empty place. Just go there and observe. And keep going back to square one, keep going back to zero, and see what happens. And when you answer one koan, there's another one waiting for you, okay? And over time, little by little, it's like this barrier is taken away, and this barrier is taken away, and this barrier is taken away, and then, you know what? It's like that imperturbability is always present, you know, almost always present. And you can be in the middle of Grand Central Station, and be, you know, you could be in the middle of a traffic accident, or. And you can be as calm, and every muscle in your body will be calm. And if that's not happening yet, you know, as I said, day one or day two of Sesshin, you know, when something like the sound of that annoys you, just follow the sound back to Mu. Actually, anything observed continuously will take you to mu. Anything you look at continuously will return you to mu. Anything you hear will return you to mu. So even that annoying beep, if you keep listening, you'll notice your mind just becomes blank, blank, blank. And that's quite remarkable. So, anyway. A monk asked Joshu, what is Joshu? What is this self? And Joshu said, the open east gate, the open west gate, the open north gate, the open south gate. So please, let's all be, follow Joshu's path, and someday all of us will be like Joshu. It will be wonderful to have no obstructions. Yeah?